You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, released earlier this month, provides a stark reminder of what awaits the planet unless more steps are taken to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. This report was more precise than the last one in 2013 and warned temperatures may pass a tipping point within the next decade. That could mean sea levels rising even more and more extreme weather like hurricanes, heat waves, droughts, and flooding. With us today is Dr. Michael Mann, an author, distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State University, who is one of the world's most respected scientists on climate change. His latest book is The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Always good to have Dr. Mann on the program. Dr. Michael Mann, let me ask kind of what would be the last question first. What are the most significant takeaways from this report?
Yeah, thanks, Scott. It's good to be with you. And the most important takeaway is that, you know, the IPCC has really connected the dots here in a way that we haven't seen in previous reports. They've more or less come out and said those extreme weather events that we're now seeing play out this very summer, the unprecedented heat waves and wildfires and floods, we would not be seeing these if not for the warming of the planet caused by human-produced carbon pollution. It has made these events more extreme, and we will see even more widespread and extreme weather events in the future if we fail to act quickly.
Something you're referring to, a term that I've heard for the first time, and I'm sure many people have heard for the first time, attribution science. Is that what you're referring to? What is it?
Yeah, that's part of part of what's led the IPCC to connect the dots, so-called detection and attribution. And the idea here is that you can run two different kinds of experiments with the same climate model. You can subject the climate model to pre-industrial conditions, the levels of carbon dioxide that existed before industrialization. And you can do a parallel simulation where you account for the increase in carbon dioxide in the greenhouse effect from fossil fuel burning and other human activities. And in both simulations, you see how often a particular event happens, like, say, that Pacific Northwest heat dome we heard so much about earlier this summer. And you can compare how often did it happen when we accounted for greenhouse warming? How often did it happen when we didn't? And if there is a large enough increase in the frequency of that sort of event in the simulation where you accounted for the increased carbon pollution, you can say that event was this much more likely because of human-caused warming. In the case of that Pacific Northwest, heat dome, those sorts of experiments have suggested that climate change made that event as much as 30 or 40,000 times more likely. When you have that dramatic an increase in the likelihood, you can pretty much say, yeah, it was greatly, not only was it greatly increased in likelihood, when it happens barely, you know, ever in the simulation where you didn't increase the concentration of greenhouse gases, and it happens a lot in the simulation where you did, you can essentially start to draw a causal connection. You can say this event simply wouldn't have happened in the absence of the warming of the planet caused by human-generated carbon pollution. And that was the conclusion they came to with that heat dome study. But many of these extreme weather events, they've done these sorts of attribution exercises. Here's the thing, those exercises probably underestimate the impact that climate change is having on these events anyway, because the models don't account for all of the ways in which climate change may be influencing these extreme weather events. In fact, some of our own research suggests that the warming of the planet has changed the jet stream in a way where you get more of these stuck weather patterns, these very big high pressure and low pressure centers that remain stuck in place. And that's when you get these unusually persistent extreme weather events. The climate models actually don't quite capture that particular effect. And so if anything, they are underestimating the impact that human-caused warming is having on these extreme weather events.
You know, I wonder whether that heat dome, that extreme, I mean, that was extreme for that region of the United States and Canada, whether that got the attention of more people, you know, taking, I don't want to say taking climate change more seriously, but making it, them realize that we're in a dangerous situation, because those were extreme temperatures for that region. I mean, you blew past high temperature records by 15, 20 degrees when you have temperatures in the, you know, 115 degrees in Canada. I mean, that just is, it's incredible.
Yeah. You know, it exceeds what many of us expected to see. Even climate scientists like myself that have been studying this problem for decades. And for decades, we said we would see more of these extreme weather events. But even we have been, I would say, taken aback by just how extreme some of these events are. And of course, it isn't that heat dome in isolation. We saw unprecedented flooding in Europe. We saw both wildfires and floods at the same time in Turkey. We have seen the hottest temperature ever measured in Europe, in Sicily. And so collectively, what we're witnessing is the signal of climate change now emerging from the noise. 2.5 decades ago, the IPCC concluded that there was a discernible human influence on the climate, which almost makes it sound like you had to squint to see it. Well, now you don't have to squint anymore. The IPCC has come out and said what we can all sort of feel viscerally with what's playing out. Climate change is here. Dangerous climate change is here. And now it's a matter of how bad we're willing to let it get.
And you've kind of touched on this, Dr. Mann, but this report states, it says there's no doubt that these temperature rises, that these changes that are occurring in the climate are due to human activity. Why is it stated as such a certainty?
Well, you know, we have seen over the decades with each new IPCC report, the statements have become more and more affirmative because, look, we're going further and further down this road. The impacts are becoming clearer and clearer. Climate change is proceeding. The signal is getting larger. And so it's easier to characterize that signal and to conclude that we can see it clearly in the data. And what's happening in the data in the real world is matching our observations. We predicted much of this decades ago. And the predictions, unfortunately, are coming true. It's the last thing you want to see as a climate scientist, your predictions coming true. But that is what's happening now. The models also give us some reason for cautious optimism at the same time, because the latest experiments clarify something that you know, was not very clear, say, a decade or two ago, which is that if we stop adding carbon pollution to the atmosphere, because of the ways that the oceans and the plants on land absorb carbon dioxide, if we stop putting it into the atmosphere through fossil fuel burning, the oceans and the terrestrial biosphere on land will continue to draw down that carbon dioxide, and those CO2 levels will start to drop. Now, balancing that out is the fact that the planet continues to warm up in response to the carbon pollution we've already put in the atmosphere because of what we call the thermal inertia, the sluggishness of the oceans and the way they absorb heat. Those two factors, it turns out, just about cancel out. And when you stop adding carbon pollution to the atmosphere, the surface temperature of the planet stops warming up within a few years. So that means that, of course, there's the urgency that we can all feel. But as I emphasize in the New Climate War, in my book, The New Climate War, there is agency. The models tell us that we can have a direct and immediate impact if we act.
Well, that's one of the keys. You know, there was some reason. I detected a little more optimism in this report than in previous reports. The last one is in 2013. But when I say a little more optimism, not that we're ready to declare victory just yet. But what this report did was it had five scenarios for levels of emissions. and the results of the levels of emissions. Can you talk a little bit about that and what is most likely?
Yeah, and you know, the IPCC is comfortable making projections of the physical climate. They're much less comfortable making projections of human behavior. They don't know what we're going to do. They don't know what our politicians are going to do, and they don't pretend to know that. What they do is present us with a number of different scenarios, scenarios where we really get our act together. We curtail fossil fuel burning. We stabilize carbon dioxide levels below 450 parts per million in the atmosphere, which is what we would need to do to prevent warming of more than 2 degrees Celsius. There is a scenario that even is more assumes more dramatic action, that we really get our act together, and then we can stabilize warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius. But then there are the worst case scenarios where we fail to act, and carbon dioxide concentrations reach 2 times, 3 times pre-industrial levels or more by the end of the century. So much of, you know, what happens in the future is still very much in our hands. It depends on what we do. There is still time to take the actions necessary to prevent the planet from warming below beyond 1.5 degrees Celsius. That's about 3 degrees Fahrenheit. But it would require us to reduce carbon emissions by 50% within the next decade. It's a monumental task, but it's possible. There are no physical obstacles. There are only political obstacles at this point.
Okay, what you were just talking about, and I said that there was some reason for optimism, but the report also says that if we continue on the path we're on right now, that within a decade or so, we could reach a tipping point. What does that mean?
Yeah, so the report is sort of, it's somewhat circumspect on this issue of tipping points, because it isn't like there's a single climate tipping point. There are many potential tipping points. And a tipping point is where you sort of push the system beyond the point of no return. So it's sort of like, if you push a ball off a cliff, there's no way to get that ball back to the top of the cliff without a lot of work. So there are these tipping points where you push the system, you push it, it responds sort of slowly, and then all of a sudden you reach some critical threshold where it shifts into a new state. And one of the concerns is that this happens with the continental ice sheets, with the Greenland and the West Antarctic ice sheet, that we destabilize them by melting the ice shelves and by warming the oceans. We destabilize these ice sheets to the point where they begin to disintegrate. And once they do, there are all these positive feedbacks, we call them self-reinforcing mechanisms, that make that more or less unstoppable. Even if we had our hand firmly on the carbon dioxide knob and could turn it back down to pre-industrial levels, we wouldn't be able to stop that from proceeding. So that's one of the tipping points that we really worry about, because there's some evidence that we're beginning to see that. We're beginning to see the destabilization of the large parts of the West Antarctic ice sheet, perhaps the Greenland ice sheet, enough ice to ultimately give us not feet, but meters of sea level rise. And that's one of the upward revisions in this report. A couple IPCC reports 15 years ago or so, the IPCC was talking about maybe a foot or 2 feet of sea level rise by the end of this century. And they admitted that they couldn't take into account the behavior of the ice sheets because they weren't able to model them well enough. Well, now we have a better handle on that. Now those contributions are at least provisionally included in the projections. And the IPCC says, look, if we act dramatically, there's a chance we can limit sea level rise to under a meter or a meter and a half. That would still be destabilizing. That would still require massive sort of migrations from our coastline. It would require all sorts of adaptive measures to deal with it, but it would be within our adaptive capacity, a meter to a meter and a half, 3, 4, 5 feet of sea level rise over a century. We could probably deal with that. But what they say is, in the worst case scenario, where we continue to burn fossil fuels at historic rates, we could be talking about, 5-6 meters of sea level rise within a century or so. And there's some uncertainty in how fast it can happen. And then we're talking about flooding, you know, the major coastal cities of the world, hundreds of millions of people being displaced. And so it's a tale of two scenarios, one where we act boldly and can limit the damage and keep it within our adaptive capacity, and another where we continue down this road of fossil fuel burning and likely exceed our adaptive capacity as a civilization, i.e., we see the destabilization of our civilization writ large.
Dr. Mann, the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement set some temperature goals, and they're addressed in this report. That would be that the temperature rises to 2 degrees Celsius or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Ideally, they would be kept below 1.5 degrees Celsius. This report says that on our current path, that we will go past those temperatures, as I mentioned, and you talked about what happens then. How did we, for the average person to hear, 2 degrees Celsius or 3 degrees Fahrenheit, they think that doesn't sound like a whole lot, but each little bit contributes to a change on the planet, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the last ice age was only a few degrees colder globally than today. And so small, relatively small changes in global average temperature can lead to monumental changes in climate. It's worth keeping in mind, for example, that we're seeing heat waves now, as you alluded to earlier, that are breaking records by 10 degrees or 15 degrees. We're not just breaking records, we're shattering them. And there was a study that came out just a few weeks ago that found that these records will tend not just to be broken, but indeed to be shattered. As we warm the planet, we see more and more extreme weather, and the old records are broken by even greater amounts, the heat waves, the wildfires, the floods. It has to do really just with the mathematics of the bell curve. If your listeners are familiar with the bell curve, is the curve that described grades on exams in college, determined what grade you got. It's a bell shape with a peak in the middle, which is the highest probability, which is right at the average. And then it sort of slopes down on either side in the shape of a bell, where you get lower and lower probabilities of events that are farther and farther away from the average. And it turns out that when you move that curve, when you warm up the planet, you're basically shifting that bell curve. And what happens is the area under the far tail of that curve gets a lot larger. So when you warm the planet by just 1 degree Celsius, and we've warmed more than that now, you tend to take events that might have been, say, 100-year events, or that shouldn't have happened more often than once in 100 years, and you turn them into 10-year events, and eventually into 1-year events. And so you get a really large increase in the frequency of the extreme events, even with a modest shift in the average temperature. And you see, the collapsing of ice sheets. You warm up the planet a few degrees. It's sort of like a fever, right? A fever is just our bodies warming up by a few degrees, but that can be deadly. Well, now the entire planet is undergoing a fever. And as we have seen, it can be deadly to all of us, for all of us.
This report, for the first time, also broke down how different regions of the planet will be impacted or could be impacted by climate change. Let's talk a little bit about Pennsylvania. What impact is there? What are we looking at here in Pennsylvania as a result of climate change on our current path?
Yeah, so, we've had some withering heat waves in recent years here in Pennsylvania, but probably more sort of, more seared into our consciousness is the terrible flooding events in Wilkes-Barre, in that area some years ago. We saw this derecho event impact eastern Pennsylvania, Philadelphia. This is a line of extremely strong thunderstorms that bring, tornadic sort of strength winds with them and can do great damage. They can sort of you know, they can wipe out access to power, electricity for millions of people. These sorts of events are becoming more frequent as we warm up the planet, and we expect them to become even more frequent as we continue to go down this path. And so we're sort of seeing these extreme events locally, but at the same time, you know, no state is an island. Pennsylvania isn't an island. We, you know, benefit from goods and services and agricultural products from around the country and around the world. And one of the other things that climate change is doing is disrupting supply chains and distribution systems. And that's a problem for all of us. So when one area suffers, when the Western U.S. suffers under these unprecedented heat, wildfires, and of course, California is a source, a great source of produce for the rest of the country. So when a region like California suffers, we all suffer. We live in an interconnected country and an interconnected world. So yes, there are the local impacts of climate change. And, you know, I sometimes joke, Jersey Shore, Pennsylvania doesn't have to worry about sea level rise. And to your listeners who aren't familiar with it, Jersey Shore is a town in the middle of Pennsylvania. It's not on the Jersey Shore. But so many of us, of course, from Pennsylvania have gone to the Jersey Shore in the summer. And, you know, the Jersey Shore is impacted by sea level rise, by more devastating hurricanes. We all remember from Hurricane Sandy, the roller coaster that was washed out to sea by Superstorm Sandy as it hit Brigantine. So let's keep in mind that while there are local impacts that are going to be detrimental to us, there are these larger impacts that are going to impact all of us.
We have a question here from a listener. Tom says, can you discuss the changes in nighttime temperatures? They seem to be rising even faster than daytime temperatures.
Yeah, you know, nighttime temperatures are greatly impacted, it turns out, by greenhouse gases, by cloud cover. And so as we warm up the planet, there's more humidity in the atmosphere. It's harder for the ground to cool off at night. And so we actually see a very large increase in many regions in those, nighttime minimum temperatures. And that turns out to be a real problem when it comes to heat stress, particularly for the elderly, for young children whose bodies aren't as aren't as well equipped to deal with heat stress. What happens as those night times get warmer in the summer, bodies don't have as much time to sort of recover from the daytime heat. And in the great Chicago heat wave some decades ago, there was a massive loss of life of the young and the elderly. And this is something that our own studies have predicted, as much as a tripling of heat stress in the decades ahead. If we continue to warm the planet, and much of that heat stress comes from those rising daytime, nighttime minimum temperatures, where the nights are so warm that those who don't have air conditioning, they don't have access to sort of the modern comforts that some of us have, they don't have a chance to recover from that daytime heat. And so that's a real concern. And it is sort of part of what the climate projections indicate.
You mentioned earlier that solutions to this, much of it will be political. Let's go back to Pennsylvania. How would you, let me ask it this way. What should Pennsylvania lawmakers take away from this most recent IPCC report? What can they do to act now?
Yeah, so, you know, we have a governor, for example, a Democratic governor who has now joined has committed Pennsylvania to join a regional consortium of Northeastern and Mid-Atlantic states called REGI. It's a regional consortium of states that are providing incentives for decarbonizing our economy, pricing carbon, providing subsidies for renewable energy. So that's a good development. Pennsylvania joining with a larger network of states that are committed to policy action. In the absence of a national climate policy, we don't yet have, you know, a congressional climate bill that has passed Congress that would would do these things. And so we sort of need to do them at the state level. And it's great that Pennsylvania has joined that consortium. But at the same time, we have a Republican-led state house that has pretty much done everything it can to prevent the increased access to renewable energy. That's really important as well. We need our state legislators and our local legislators to also provide incentives to help us shift away from our reliance on fossil fuel energy toward wind and solar. And we're seeing those, solar and wind energy, we're seeing great growth there, but it's being held back by the fact that we don't have the sorts of incentives for renewable energy that state legislators are more than happy to provide for fossil fuel energy. We've got this perverse incentive structure where we're actually providing subsidies for the fossil fuel industry, which is hurting the planet through climate change and not providing similar incentives to the renewable energy industry. And that's a problem really with our state level legislation and a Republican state house that has refused to really commit itself to acting meaningfully to address the climate crisis. And that's where, you know, our votes matter. If you care about the climate crisis, and you better, because it's the existential threat that we all face, it's the greatest threat we all face, then you need to vote on climate. You need to find out where politicians stand when it comes to renewable energy, the renewable energy transition, and acting on climate. You need to figure out where they stand. Vote in politicians who will act on our behalf, do something about climate change, and vote out those who refuse to, who instead remain rubber stamps for the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah, but you're well aware, because you've heard from them very often, is that there are many people, including in our legislature, who just won't admit that the climate is changing. I mean, I have an email here from a listener who wants to compare, saying that temperatures were high 900 AD in North America and Europe, and was talking about a mini ice age and 1,000 years after that. So, you know, when we're talking about having to take the actions to mitigate this, until you get more people who will admit that this is actually happening, will there be made the kind of changes needed?
Yeah, so this is another theme of the new climate war is actually we've pretty much seen a death spiral of denialism. Now, there's still, you know, a perpetuation of climate change denial in some circles in the right-wing media. And, you know, and you do hear people say, well, what about 1,000 years ago? It was warmer than. No, it wasn't. The IPCC report, the latest IPCC report, makes it very clear that the warming we've seen over the last century exceeds anything for at least the past 2,000 years and likely several hundred thousand years. We are now warming at a rate that is unprecedented in several hundred thousand years. So that's what the science has to say. But there are still these talking points, and you do hear them recycled on conservative talk shows and Fox News, et cetera. But there are studies that have been done, sort of demographic studies, to see where the American public stands right now. And it turns out there's only about 9% of the public now that are so-called dismissives, that actually don't accept that climate change is happening. It's a tiny sliver. It feels like there's much more than that, because they have this megaphone in the form of the right-wing media, and they do their best to sort of promote those talking points and create an echo chamber. But in terms of actual human beings in this country, only about 9% now deny that climate change is real. And a solid majority, even of Republicans under the age of 40, a solid majority accept that climate change is real, and they actually want to see something done about it. They want to see us move towards renewable energy. So look, we're not going to There is this sort of very resistant fringe that we're never going to convince. No amount of evidence is going to change their mind because they see this purely through an ideological lens, and it's sort of become part of the cultural identity of conservatism in this country to some extent to deny climate change. But there are overwhelming majorities now that are in favor of climate action, and what we need to do is speak to them. Speak to those in the middle who, you know, the confused middle, as I describe them. They don't, you know, they're not climate change deniers, but they're not yet convinced that this is that much of a problem. With a little more information and providing them with resources, we can sort of, we can really move them into the category of people who are concerned and willing to be on the front lines demanding action. So I actually think that despite the fear of climate tipping points that we could be nearing if we continue to warm up the planet, there is a tipping point of the good kind that looms in our future. And that's where we do see this sort of emergence of a solid majority of Americans who not only accept that climate change is happening, but they really prioritize it. They want their policymakers to do something about it, Republican and Democratic alike.
Maybe the people I'm going to refer to in this question are what you just described as being in the middle, because we've heard this from some lawmakers and from others as well that will point to China and India's, the emissions coming from China and India, for example. And just recently it was made the news about constructing coal-fired power plants as a way, now they've used this as a way to dismiss state or national emissions, argue that Pennsylvania, the United States, is already doing enough and that it will put the state or the country at a competitive disadvantage in the global economy. What do you say to them? Because again, this is not new. We've heard this for a long time. What about China? What about India?
Yeah. So we call this whataboutism, right? Yeah. It's a phenomenon. It's sort of a social phenomenon now, part of our political discourse, often used by bad faith actors. They say, oh, but what about this? What about that? People who don't want to talk about the matter at hand, and distraction and deflection, as I talk about in the new climate war, is a major tactic in the so-called new climate war. It's a way of preventing us from acting. It stops short of outright denialism, but sort of tries to throw other obstacles in our path. The reality is that, look, we are the largest emitter historically by far of carbon pollution on the planet. We're currently the second largest emitter. China is emitting more carbon now than we are at this time. And they, of course, are industrializing. But we have been an industrial nation for more than two centuries. In fact, fossil fuels started here in Pennsylvania. It's where we discovered oil. The state was built on coal. And it helped grow our economy, and that was good. But something better has come along now, and it's time for us to move on here in Pennsylvania, here in the United States, and to take real leadership on this issue. And look, you know, if we are to tackle this problem, we can't afford for India and South American countries to go through the same fossil fuel stage that we went through. If they do that, we're going to blow past those targets in a matter of decades. What we need to do is to provide incentives and help them leapfrog past that stage of dirty fossil fuel energy and develop a clean energy infrastructure. It makes more sense. Clean energy is cheaper now on a levelized basis. It makes much more sense for countries that are now industrializing to go directly to clean energy and smart grid technology and skip past this unnecessary dirty fossil fuel stage that we in the industrial world went through. And at the time, it made sense, but it doesn't make sense anymore. So let's lead on this issue here in the United States, as the Biden administration is trying to do. Of course, we need Congress to comply. We need, you know, that climate bill, this current package, reconciliation package that has major climate policy within it. We need that to pass Congress, and Americans need to put pressure on their policymakers, on their politicians, so that we do pass this legislation. We do codify our commitment to leading on the issue of climate change. And then we bring the rest of the world with us. We're seeing that now. We're seeing other You know, countries come to the table. Now the United States is playing a leadership role, but we can't just make pledges. We have to actually put in place policies that allow us to keep those pledges.
Dr. Michael Mann, his latest book is The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet, a distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State University. Dr. Mann, always great talking with you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much.